This is the son of PCJ.
Media Network Plus, produced and presented by Paulette McQuarrie and Keith Perron.
Well, hello, friends and listeners. Welcome again to another edition of the program. Coming up today, our own Paulette McQuarrie will join us to talk about a decision made by the Supreme Court of Canada over a long-running dispute between cable companies and private television stations. Also, 2012. Well, it was a very deadly year for journalists all around the world. We're going to find out a little more about that. Stay tuned. This is Media Network Plus, the show that plugs you in and charges you no extra fees. But first, here's Paulette McQuarrie with a look at some of the headlines from the world of media.
MTV Russia is closing 14 years after the channel launched in the country. Owner Prof Media has decided not to renew the license it had held from Viacom Media Networks since 2007 for the MTV brand and associated content. A new general entertainment channel, Pyatnitsya, will replace the channel in June of 2013. According to local reports, the number of viewers in the channel's target group has decreased from 2.2% in 2010 to 1.6% last year. MTV Russia launched in 1998, with Prof Media acquiring the license in 2007. An MTV spokesperson said that it is currently exploring a number of opportunities for MTV in Russia and will continue to air four music channels in the market: MTV Hits, MTV Dance, MTV Rocks, and MTV HD. Bloomberg Television announced the formation of a partnership in Indonesia with the Idea Group, a Jakarta-based media and strategic communication holding company, to launch Bloomberg Television Indonesia in early 2013. Presented in Bahasa Indonesia, Bloomberg Television Indonesia will bring Bloomberg News alongside locally produced content to Southeast Asia's largest economy. Bloomberg TV Indonesia will partner with existing broadcast entities and air on free-to-air, pay TV, internet, and mobile platforms. Belarusian pay TV operator Cosmos TV has added news channels from France and China to its lineup. Viewers can now watch French and English language versions of France 24 in the basic and cognitive packages. The channel is joined by Chinese news channel CCTV News, which airs in English and is available in the basic package, and local language version CCTV Russian, which now forms part of the entertainment package. The board of directors at the National Voice of America Museum of Broadcasting is a step closer to more autonomous operations at the historical structure. On December 4th, Westchester Township trustees approved a lease agreement with the museum's executive board. Pending final approval by Secretary of the Interior of the United States, the museum board of directors will be responsible for its development, management, programming, use, operations, and maintenance of the facility and grounds. According to Barb Wilson, township spokeswoman, the township will continue ownership of the building, while the museum board will cover the costs of utilities and maintenance. The township has been in control of the facility since the 1990s, when the federal government decommissioned and donated it. On the National Register of Historic Places, the National Voice of America Museum of Broadcasting features the collections of the Great History of Wireless Museum and Media Heritage, Inc., as well as the Westchester Amateur Radio Association. For these and other news stories in the global media industry, visit the Kim Andrew Elliott blog. You can find a link to it at the bottom of our homepage, www.pcjmedia.com. That's the news and media for this week. I'm Paulette McQuarrie.
And you're listening to Media Network Plus, coming to you from PCJ Radio International, heard on the World Radio Network, Sky Digital, Sirius XM, and through great partner stations everywhere. Paulette, on December the 13th, the Supreme Court of Canada struck down something that the CRTC, which is the Canadian Radio and Television Commission, allowed. That would mean cable companies that carry different TV stations would have to pay those companies money for carrying them on their cable networks. Now, the Supreme Court of Canada pushed away the decision from the CRTC. So what is this going to mean for people who have cable television in Canada?
Well, it's going to mean basically the status quo, Keith. Not much is going to change. And this has been the whole argument all along, is cable companies were insisting that if they had to pay this new fee for carriage, that the cost would be passed down to the consumers. And the Supreme Court has argued that the CRTC had no authority to force the cable companies to pay broadcasters.
Okay, but you know, one of the questions that's in my mind right now is, let's say the cable company said, you know what, okay, we're not going to carry that channel. And of course, there are many, many people across Canada that, I mean, it's one of the most popular forms of accessing television programs. Aren't the TV stations afraid that, well, if cable companies say, you know what, you're going to charge me this amount, forget it, I'm not going to carry you. They're going to be losing a whole customer base?
Well, I don't, obviously it didn't, because this has been going on for quite a few years, Keith, and they felt that their programming was indispensable. I don't know. That question really has never come up in the discussion at all.
Was this a unanimous decision by the Supreme Court?
Well, actually, there were four judges, Keith, that did dissent, and they did feel that the Broadcasting Act allowed them the right to do this, to charge distributors for their content. But the Supreme Court, the majority, disagreed, and this was based on an interpretation of the Copyright Act that is currently in place here in Canada.
Now, the United States, of course, is Canada's closest neighbor. What is their system in place?
Well, they actually have a system that the CRTC agreed to implement. And the problem, though, with that is there are blackouts, because there are these arguments between the cable companies and the content providers, the network. So perhaps that is one of the issues that Canada wants to avoid. I don't know. That's just speculation on my part. At any rate, it all goes back to the Broadcasting Act.
You know, there was something that I remember years ago in Canada. It's definitely the same now. If you had, say, a commercial broadcaster like CTV broadcasting a show from NBC at exactly the same time, cable operators in Canada had to carry the CTV feed on the NBC channel. They couldn't show the American commercials. They had to show the Canadian commercials. But yet in the United States, stations, let's say in Seattle or in Vermont or in cities that border Canada, they don't have to do that.
Well, no, this is a way, I guess, of protecting the industry in Canada. And yes, they have to black out the U.S. commercials, or at least at one time they did, and put the local, the Canadian commercials. Perhaps in the States they have to put local commercials in the areas. I'm not sure how that works, Keith, but certainly that has been the case, that there was a Canadian version of U.S. programs being broadcast on the cable networks.
Now, what are consumers saying about this, and what are the programmers saying about this?
Well, the programmers are saying that there could be a loss of a lot of local programming. For example, TV stations in places like Yorkton, Saskatchewan, which was my old stomping grounds. I remember very well watching TV there, and when there was only one channel, it was quite the to-do when there was a second channel that came in over the air. And places like Timmins, Ontario as well. And other small communities are going to lose their local programming simply because they can't afford to keep them anymore under the current model. Back in the old days, when I was watching CKOS in Yorkton, for example, it was CBC, and the CBC was had all these affiliate stations in smaller areas, but the CBC isn't doing that anymore.
You know, there's something here that I find a little bit mystifying, let's say, on the side of the broadcasters. We saw Canada just quite recently switch from analog to digital television. There's many areas of Canada that are no longer served because of the lower power that you use with digital TV. But in these areas, maybe people would have access to a local cable company. So are they just not worried at all? Let's say that, the local cable company doesn't want to carry us on cable anymore. They want to put maybe something else. We've just lost maybe 100,000 viewers because people can't even watch us through the old-fashioned system of rabbit ears.
Well, that is mystifying to me as well, Keith. They basically have cut off, they've limited their distribution system. They've downgraded their distribution system and made it inaccessible to more viewers by going digital instead of over the air. And I don't know. I can't answer that question because I'm just as stumped as you are.
You know, because it is kind of...
It doesn't make any sense.
You know, it is kind of odd because if you think about it, I mean, if I look at it from the outside, I see the broadcasters actually getting a pretty good deal. They're getting free distribution to millions of people. And it's the cable companies. I mean, it's not cheap, of course, to distribute. They have to have a whole network set up. They need technicians to have this network set up. You would think that they would be like, oh, this is good for us. We don't have to pay for any type of distribution.
Well, I think that they don't see that as a benefit in the same way that the record labels in the music industry don't understand that either. And I think the whole thing is started out to talking about status quo for the viewers, but it's not status quo for the producers, the content producers. It's a lot more expensive now than it was, say, 50 years ago, or you know, perhaps even 20 years ago to produce the content. And the advertising revenues just aren't there because there's so much more competition now for advertising. When TV started, advertising was essentially quite a new medium. There wasn't internet. There wasn't satellite radio. There wasn't a 500 channel universe in those days. So there's a lot more competition, and the producers of the content are finding it a lot more expensive to produce the content as well. They're back in the day, people did content for free, like you and I do, for the most part. And now you've got union wages. So it's very, the whole landscape has changed. And there are going to be changes, I think, on the horizon. Who's going to be producing the content is hard to say. If the private companies stop doing it, I don't know.
You know, it's kind of funny because in some countries where they've tried to pass a similar type of rule where cable companies had to pay TV stations to carry on their network, these stations, many of them actually, the cable companies said, well, you know what? We don't want to pass this cost along to the consumer. So we're going to carry TV stations and content providers that we don't have to pay for. So, you know, tough cookies on you. And what happened was these stations, they saw their viewership go down. They couldn't charge as much for advertising. And they're now in a more difficult financial situation than they were to begin with.
Well, and I can see that happening here too, because I don't think that there is a lot of foresight, and I don't think there's a whole lot of understanding, even on the part within the industry, much less the viewing public. I mean, the viewing public resents the advertisements. They seem to have this sense of entitlement now that they can get the good programming for free simply because they're used to it. And you know, I've read some of the comments and some of the articles have been published on the internet, and some are suggesting that you know viewers should be paid for watching ads without understanding that it is those free ads that provide the free content that they enjoy. And if you eliminate the advertising, you're going to eliminate your content along with it, because nobody's willing to pay subscriptions except for the cable. And the cable companies are having problems too, because a lot of people are saying they're getting rid of their cable because it's becoming a lot more expensive. Cable companies have an advantage in that they can bundle in internet along with it, but the whole industry is morphing, Keith. Distribution with the internet has changed everything.
Paying people to watch advertising, that's like paying school children to go to school.
Well, I think that's the level of the understanding. Not to insult, the viewing public, but it is a very complicated industry, and it is all about business. I mean, very few people are willing to go on the radio or TV like you and I and provide service just because we love it. Amateur radios, most of our listeners understand that, especially the DXers in that community. But the average viewer, they come home from work, they're tired, they want to turn on the TV, and they don't want to watch garbage. And unfortunately, a lot of that is free to produce.
But when it comes to commercials, I mean, you can easily say, well, then don't watch it. Go get a drink. Just do something else.
Well, right, but it disrupts the flow of the story, right? I mean, it's like somebody reading a book and taking, if you're reading a book and someone takes it away from you and wants to talk to you for a while, you get a little bit annoyed because, you know, the story's been interrupted. And so, you know, there's that sense of disruption that people don't like. It's what is it called? Interruption marketing. But that's the model that's been used. That has been what's financed. That's what's created the whole entertainment industry, the television and radio industry. And advertisers have been the lifeblood. But there is so much more competition, so many people with the technology, anybody like you and I were able to start up our own radio program. And things are changing. You know, at first, everyone and their dog and uncle were producing a podcast, but now things are kind of going back, settling down again to more or less where they were before. The big players have moved on into the market, and they remain big because they have the deep pockets to provide the good content, and that's what people want. But I think that there's a shakedown going on, and it's going to be very interesting to see what happens.
Well, I'm sure, Paulette, as this story develops, we'll keep our listeners informed. You're listening to Media Network Plus from PCJ Radio International.
Call the PCJ answer line at country code 44-20-3286-1399. That's country code 44-20-3286-1399 and leave your comments and questions. On shortwave, satellite, and the internet, this is PCJ Radio.
It's been a deadly year for journalists covering political upheaval around the world. The latest report from the Committee to Protect Journalists shows more political reporters than war correspondents were killed in 2012. 67 journalists have lost their lives in the line of duty so far this year, including 28 in Syria. The vast majority were local reporters and camera operators. Only 6% were foreigners. Joel Simon is the executive director of the Committee to Protect Journalists. He speaks to Sally Sarah from Radio Australia.
The reality is that most journalists who are killed around the world year after year, it's 85-90%, are local journalists who are killed in their own country. They're covering politics, they're covering human rights, they're covering corruption, and they're targeted for murder by people within that society who don't want their activities exposed.
So from your figures, it's almost showing that being a political journalist is more dangerous than being a war correspondent.
Absolutely the case. That's in no way to minimize the threats that war correspondents face. And this year, in fact, we've seen a huge increase in the number of journalists covering conflicts because of what's happening in Syria, which has been devastating for journalists. But year after year, if you look at the long-term statistics, it's journalists working in their own countries, reporting on political corruption, reporting on political scandal, reporting on human rights violations, who bear the risk and bear the consequences for that kind of coverage.
And what does your research show you about, with the best information that you have, who's responsible for those killings?
Well, it's often local political forces within the country. Sometimes they're politicians themselves who have organized killings. Sometimes there are criminal organizations with ties to political groups. Sometimes there are militant groups that also operate with some sort of political protection. So the political environment is often the crucial determining factor. And you know what else is absolutely determinative is impunity. In country after country, if the killers of journalists are not brought to justice, then the cycle of violence is perpetuated. And we see that in places like the Philippines, like Russia, like Mexico, like Pakistan, like Somalia. Year after year, those countries are on the lists of the most deadly for the press.
Tell us about the countries that have come in, if you like, the top 20 most dangerous countries for journalist deaths. I noticed that Afghanistan is not there, but Syria is sitting at the top.
Yeah, Syria has just been unbelievably deadly for the press. In fact, the number of journalists killed in Syria this year is rivaled only by Iraq at the height of the conflict. It's really been devastating. And you're seeing two classes of journalists who are killed. You're seeing the traditional kind of international correspondent who goes into Syria and Often there have been a few that have actually been abducted, but often they find themselves in crossfire and a number have been killed. But local journalists are also incredibly vulnerable, and many of these journalists are not traditional journalists. They're kind of activist journalists with ties to the Free Syrian Army who perhaps are integrated into networks of activists. But they're playing a crucial role. They're documenting the day-to-day reality. They're disseminating information to a global public. So they're really playing a journalistic role. And about 13 of them have died as a result of their activities.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that group because I know in other countries, in India, for example, those activists who are involved in a right to information, which is their equivalent of FOI, freedom of information, that's become a very dangerous task as well. Is there enough recognition of these people that provide information but are activists as well?
You know, it's really been evolving, obviously. I mean, it used to be pretty easy to say where journalism ends and activism begins, but that's not the case anymore. There's so many groups around the world that use the gathering and disseminating of information, which is essentially a journalistic function, to advance their activist goals. And these include human rights groups, environmental groups, groups agitating for greater freedom of information. But we believe that in many cases, not all, and we look at each case very carefully, they're playing a fundamentally journalistic role. And so we classify them as journalists and we count them as journalists when they're killed.
So this group of activists slash journalists, they're often bringing out footage and information from areas that traditional news organisations can't or don't want to venture into. In some ways, is this group taking some of the hits for the traditional media?
Yeah, well, I think that what you're seeing around the world is that repressive governments recognise that in order to retain power, they need to control the flow of information. And so you're seeing a real showdown in many places around the world, places like Iran, in China, in the Middle East, in Egypt and Tunisia during the revolutions that took place there, a real concerted battle over who controls information. And in many cases, it's activists slash journalists that are playing the role of documenting and disseminating both to a domestic audience and to a global public what is transpiring in these countries. And they're paying a huge price. Many have been killed. Increasing numbers are being jailed. And they're working without institutional support. When they get in trouble, it's not like a journalist who has a media organization behind them. They have nobody. They have the Committee to Protect Journalists. They have media organizations. But they're much more vulnerable. And governments recognize this, and they're going on the offensive.
That was Joel Simon, the executive director of the Committee to Protect Journalists, speaking to Sally Sarah from Radio Australia. You're listening to Media Network Plus, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. Now, I want to tell you about a couple of program notes that we have, well, beginning next week. Beginning next week, by the way, is going to be the year-end specials for this program. We're going to have a 30-minute edition, as we do weekly, and the monthly 55-minute edition that we have once a month, that will be focusing on the lighter side of broadcasting, and that's coming up next week. Now, I want to tell you about a special program that's taking place in 2 years. What does that mean? I know that sounds a little strange, but actually, for listeners, it will begin on December 31st, 2012, and conclude on January 1st, 2013. Yes, I know that really. So yes, we're going to be doing some time traveling, you can say. No, that is going to be for the annual Happy Station Show year-end special. Normally in the past, I think the program was 2 hours. This year, we're going to be going for a whole full hours. And my co-host for that will be our own Paulette McCrory. The times are the following. Let me give you the UTC time first. From 02:00 to 0600 hours UTC on January 1st, 2013. For those living on the eastern coast of North America, that is from 9 p.m. Eastern Time until 1 a.m. Eastern Time, beginning December 31st, 2012, and continuing all the way to January 1st, 2013. The frequency for that special program is 9,000 955 kilohertz. That's 9,955 kilohertz. Now, if you are outside this area, you may not be able to listen to it because it is predominantly targeting the Americas. That's Latin, the Caribbean, and North America. But if you're outside this area and you tune in from 2 to 6 hours UTC January 1st, go to www.wrmi.net. That's www.wrmi.net. And you can catch the full hours. Now, some of our partner stations, by the way, will be also relaying the program on FM and medium wave. I don't have the full complete list with me, but don't worry because there will be a link at the PCJ Media website where you can actually listen to the audio stream as we do the show live. So do check us out at the end of the year. Also, by the way, the information that I just told you about is available at www.pcjmedia.com. Well, it's now time for propagation, and this is going to be the final propagation forecast for 2012. Dan Hensley, of course, will join us next year for more of it. So we now bring you the final one for this year, and I just have this uneasy suspicion that he's going to be right again. I'm hoping for a point that he is wrong, so we can always, you know, jab him and say, ha-ha, we got you this time. Anyway, here's Dan Hensley.
The 10.7 centimeter flux is 115 from December 22nd to December 25th. December 26th and 27th will have a 10.7 centimeter flux of 110, dropping down to 100 on December 28th. We'll have an A index of 5 all week long, that's from December 22nd to December 28th, and a KP index of 2 December 22nd to December 28th. Solar activity has been low for weeks. Would adding a new sunspot change the situation? The answer is emerging over the sun's northeast limb. December 18th, the NASA Solar Dynamics Observatory took a photo of this new sunspot. The region is crackling with low-level C-class solar flares, which does not signal a significant uptick in solar activity. However, the sunspot group has only been visible for a few hours as of December 19th, so it might have potential for greater eruptions. Sunspots 1629, 31, and 32 are passing out of view this week, while 1633 and 34 are in view to the far west of the Earth's facing side of the sun. As of December 19th, Earth is inside a stream of solar wind flowing from a coronal hole on the sun's far southeast region facing the Earth. Back to you, Keith.
Okay, thank you very much, Dan Hensley. Anyway, with that, we've come to the end of the program. We're going to leave you today with a little bit of Ray Conniff. Yes, drive you people crazy. I know it's funny. Anyway, on behalf of Paulette McQuarrie and Dan Hensley, season's greetings to you all. We'll see you next week with our, well, lighter side of broadcasting look. So, until next time, 73s to you all, 88s to the ladies, and Merry Christmas.
Whisper what you bring to me. Tell me if you can.